Happy New Year! Welcome to another year of practice. Our Dharma theme for 2015 is the middle way. Of course, all of the Buddhas and ancestors' teachings convey the middle way. That's why it's the theme. And as we start the new year, you're welcome to, on your way out, take one of these, we call ufuda, these yellow slips of paper on the rack in the back that are blessings for the new year and infused with prajnaparamita chanting energy and from New Year's Day, and protection and good wishes for the year for all of you. The middle way. I was recently noticing that the mission statement for the Zen Center here has some wonderful teachings about the middle way. One of the lines in our mission statement on the website is, our understanding of the non-duality of compassion and wisdom, practice and realization has been conveyed through the Soto School of Zen. So the non-duality of compassion and wisdom, the non-duality of practice and realization is the middle way, one version of the middle way. And to elaborate further, there's a wonderful sutra that Buddha is teaching on the middle way called the Kacchayana Gotā Sutta. In the connected discourses, in the section on interdependent arising, this wonderful short teaching of the Buddha epitomizes his teaching of the middle way. It goes like this. Venerable Kacchayana approached the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed, sat down to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, Blessed One, right view, it is said. To what extent is there right view? You maybe have heard this term, right view, in the Noble Eightfold Path. In the Buddha's very first teaching ever, he taught the Noble Eightfold Path of practice, which he called the middle way. Right view is the beginning of the Eightfold Path. But this monk, Kacchayana, wants to know, what is this right view? And the Buddha answers, by and large, Kacchayana, this world is supported by a polarity or a duality, or this world is inclined toward two views, that of existence and non-existence, by and large. For the most part, this world veers towards these two views, that in spiritual traditions in the Buddha's time, and I would even propose people who don't even think of their personal philosophy or spirituality, still, without naming it as such, I think the world is inclined towards these two views. Things truly exist in and of themselves, or nothing really exists at all. And the Buddha didn't say this, but I would say that in general, especially outside of spiritual practitioner circles, the world veers towards the view that things really exist. Don't they? Seem to? So this world is inclined towards these two views or is supported by this duality. But, the Buddha says, when one sees the arising or the origination of the world as it actually is with right discernment, the notion of non-existence with reference to the world does not occur to such a person. So when one discerns the arising of a world or the arising of anything, this notion of non-existence doesn't really hold up very long. Like, what about all of us and all of this stuff happening? Here it is. How can we say nothing exists? Now, what is all this stuff if nothing exists? So if someone has a theory that nothing really exists, we just look at the arising of the world or the origination of the world as it actually is with right discernment. We see the world. And when one sees the cessation of the world as it actually is with right discernment, then existence with reference to the world does not occur to such a person. So, can you follow that? If someone feels like, nothing really exists, well, with right discernment, we view how the world arises each moment, which is shows that non-existence, complete non-existence, doesn't make any sense. And if we're holding to the view that, well, things really do exist in some kind of fixed, independent, and permanent way, then with right discernment we view the ceasing of things and the ceasing of the world. And with this discernment of the cessation of the world, then the view of true existence does not hold up anymore. So it's a pretty simple explanation of just watching how the world arises and ceases frees us from these two extreme views that things truly, inherently, independently, and permanently exist, and that things don't exist whatsoever at all. By just watching the arising, we see that refutes the view of non-existence, and by seeing cessation, that refutes the view of true existence. By and large, Kacchayana, this world is in bondage to attachments, grasping, and biases or inclinations. But one with such a right view does not get involved with or cling to these attachments, graspings, fixations of awareness, biases, or obsessions. Nor does she grasp the view of myself as a kind of fixed, truly existent entity. He has no uncertainty or doubt that just suffering or discontent when arising is arising. Discontent when passing away is passing away. In this, her knowledge is not dependent on others. Or one no longer needs to go ask some other teacher about how things are. It's to this extent, Kacchayana, that there is right view. Everything truly exists, that is one extreme. Everything doesn't exist at all, that is a second extreme. Avoiding these two extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dharma via the middle. the Tathagata, the Buddha, teaches the Dharma of the middle way, avoiding these two extremes of existence and non-existence. This is one version of the middle way. And so, relating this back to the mission statement of the Zen Center, our understanding of the non-duality of compassion and wisdom. So, with right discernment, seeing the arising of the world, there are beings arising and they're suffering. Suffering is arising in this world. Therefore, we don't hold the view of there's no suffering, there's no beings, it doesn't matter. That's that view of non-existence. We see suffering, discontent comes to be. Therefore, compassion arises. And then when we see the cessation of the world, and nothing lasts for more than a moment, and nothing can be actually found in any fixed, independent way at all, then wisdom arises. The wisdom that sees there's nothing to hold on to. So wisdom and compassion can go together as the middle way, free from the extremes of true inherent existence and total non-existence. Sometimes in English we call these the view of eternalism and annihilationism, or eternalism and nihilism in kind of Western philosophy. Free from those extremes, the appropriate conduct is called compassion. Free in the face of arising suffering beings, free from those extremes of existence and non-existence, the appropriate understanding is wisdom of the middle way. So wisdom and compassion are non-dual in the middle way, and also practice and realization are also non-dual. Again, we could apply this sutra and say that with right discernment, when we see the arising of a world and like a zendo and a cushion and a schedule, then the appropriate response is practice. Let's do some practice. We practice in the world of arising phenomena. And with the cessation of the world, we see how nothing is actually really, really here in any fixed way. Then realization is right there. So practice and realization also go together as the middle way, free from the extremes of truly existent and truly non-existent. This is, if you haven't heard this kind of thing before, it maybe sounds kind of abstract or unusual, but the more we consider these types of teachings, the more we can see how they really do pervade our life, actually. Maybe we don't think in those terms, but I think we go through our days veering in, to, by and large, into these two views of things really exist here, and therefore they're a big problem. I think most of our suffering is often caused by grasping at the inherent existence of things, including ourself. And occasionally we run into trouble with the other extreme. Things don't really exist, or it's not really real anyway, so it doesn't really matter. So in the first teaching of the Buddha, when he set in motion the wheel of Dharma, he said that practitioners who want to practice the middle way, avoid these extremes of devotion to pursuing sense pleasure, which is degrading, ignoble, common, and the ordinary way of the world. It's not that they don't appreciate pleasant experiences when they happen, but it's the devotion to pursuing them, especially in a reckless way that doesn't care for beings of this world, then that's one extreme. And then the other extreme is self-mortification, or devotion to self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and leads to no good results. Both of them really have no beneficial results. And we see how in practice especially, I think self-mortification maybe tends, you know, in Buddha's time in India, all kinds of ascetic practices, but we might even look at practices in our life as self-mortification, when maybe it's like kind of the, it's like when we're really pushing ourselves really hard to fix ourselves. Maybe that kind of spirit is a little bit veering into self-mortification, which is based on the view that things really exist. I really exist this way, and I have to like kind of pound and crush myself into a better person because I'm this way, and I gotta change this person into somebody else. And then the other view of devotion to pursuing sense pleasure is kind of based on the view that things don't really exist at all, and so it doesn't really matter what we do, because cause and effect is just an illusion anyway. So just enjoy ourselves and die. And when we die, there's nothing after that, right? Maybe in the Buddha's time, the issue of rebirth was particularly like a big topic for different spiritual practitioners. So it tended to be in those days that those who didn't believe that there was anything after death tended to be the kind of like wild partiers. Maybe hedonists, or just like, it didn't matter because this is it, we just got this life, so just enjoy to the fullest and die, and that's the end. And those who saw cause and effect playing out in this life, or in many lives, or any kind of afterlife, then maybe would take more care of cause and effect and ethical conduct in this life. So these two practical extremes of practice of self-indulgence and self-mortification are based on these two views of nothing exists and things truly exist. So that's the way the Buddha talked about it in the old days. And then when the Middle Way made its way to China, and we have lots of Zen stories about this, like case 43 in the Blue Cliff Record, Dungshan's no cold or heat. One time a monk asked Dungshan is in Japanese, Tozan, he's the toe of our Soto school, that conveys the non-duality of compassion and wisdom, practice and realization. So a monk asked Dungshan, or Tozan, when cold and heat come, how can we avoid them? You might wonder this too, and on a cold winter day. personally have a harder time in the middle of summer in this Zendo, in the middle of the day, in like the August Sesshin, when there's no more robes to take off, and just make a big pool of sweat on the cushion. But sometimes it gets really cold this time of year. When cold and heat come, how can we avoid them? And you could, you know, apply this to any difficult situations. Cold and heat is like death and life. What are we going to do about that? Dumishan said, well, why don't you go to the place where there is no cold or heat? It's a good idea. The monk said, okay, but what is the place where there's no cold or heat? Dungshan said, when it's cold, the cold kills you. When it's hot, the heat kills you. Or we might translate it as, when it's cold, let the cold just like pervade you completely. Just like, you know, so there's no you left. There's just cold. I don't think it means literally kill. Another translation is, when it's cold, the cold finishes you off. When it's hot, the heat finishes you off. When it's hot, complete hot. Nothing else. When it's cold, complete cold. Nothing else. That's the place where there's no cold or heat. In the middle way, we might think that the place where there's no cold and heat is where there's like nothing at all. That would be one extreme view. Like, maybe if we actually got like a frontal lobotomy or something like that, that would eliminate cold and heat, right? We'd have no more conceptual apparatus to complain about cold and heat. Or just maybe get into some kind of meditative trance, like is possible. In the all these yogis in India could maybe get into a deep, deep type of samadhi where there's no perception, no non-perception. Nothing's happening at all. And from a Zen perspective, even that kind of thing is veering a little bit towards that extreme of nothing at all. Whereas Zen meditation is more like we're just completely, I was going to say with whatever's happening, but that's not quite it, because then there's me with what's happening. We just completely are what's happening. So if it's cold, we are just the cold. The cold kills the me in addition to the cold. So the place where there's the middle way, where there's no cold and heat, is completely cold or completely hot. And that's where we're free from it. That's how we can, the monk says, how can we avoid them or escape them? But maybe the meaning there is, how can we be free from them? We can be free from them, letting them completely pervade our entire being. Free from the extremes of truly existent, hot and cold as something, some hot and cold in relation to me, that's like some problem to get rid of through some kind of self-mortification maybe, or there is no cold and heat at all, nothing exists whatsoever, and maybe actually we just freeze to death because we think it doesn't matter. There's some kind of middle way. The middle way of dependent arising, interdependent arising and interdependent ceasing of all things. In fact, in the sutra, the Kachayanagota Sutra, just after the Buddha said, avoiding these extremes of existence and non-existence that the Tathagata teaches the middle way, then he immediately proceeds to teach dependent co-arising, which means when there's this, this comes to be. When this ceases. When this arises, that arises. Independent relationship. When this ceases, that ceases. Everything is dependent on other conditions. Therefore, it can't be found in any independent way. So, Dogen, in commenting on this story of no cold or heat, in his essay called Spring and Autumn. Interesting that I think that he calls this essay Spring and Autumn because those are the seasons that are kind of like the middle, the middle way. He doesn't explain, I don't think, any place in this essay why he calls it the essay Spring and Autumn instead of Summer and Winter. But the whole essay is commenting on this story of Dongshan's no cold or heat. And he quotes a lot of different Chinese Zen ancestors' poems. So one of the poems is Master Chang Ling's poem. It says, within differentiation there is oneness. Oneness is differentiation. Drifting in the human world hundreds and thousands of years, again and again you want to depart but cannot. In front of the gate, just as before, weeds abound. So, we might want to depart from this human world after thousands of years. It might be getting kind of old. Escape this cold and heat cycle. But we cannot. In front of the gate, just as before, weeds abound. In front of our eye gates and ear gates, there's all this stuff. As before, we just go through this world of arising and ceasing. And isn't it like okay in the end? May it be okay, this world. We don't need to escape. Luckily, because we can't. In the old teachings, there were such stories about the escape. But in the Mahayana, great vehicle, and in the Zen tradition, there's no escape. We vow to live in these weeds to benefit other weed beings. So Dogen praised that poem. Then he quotes another poem about this heat and cold issue. Master Fu Dun, who says, well, how do you escape cold and heat? Well, go for fire when it's cold and cool yourself when it's hot. In this life, you can avoid cold and heat like this. And Dogen seems to kind of be a little critical of this poem. He says, these words seem like child's talk. What do you mean? Just like, if you're cold, light a fire, and if you're hot, turn on the air conditioner. I don't think that's necessarily what the practice of the Buddhas and ancestors is to deal with this issue of painful cold and heat. Dogen says, avoiding cold and heat is nothing other than dropping off body and mind. And of course, dropping off body and mind is also the middle way. It doesn't mean that like the atoms of the body like disintegrate into vapor or something like that. It means when it's cold, the cold kills us. When it's hot, the heat kills us. Dropping off body and mind. So how about some practical implications of this middle way. As some of you have heard, I've been looking at, there's a new book called A Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency. It's a wonderful collection of essays. And I learned some scientific facts in this Dharma book too, that at least in 2009, it's a little bit outdated, stuff changes so fast, right? At that time, at some point in this book it says, around 40% of carbon emissions come from buildings. That probably includes a lot of buildings, right? But I think a big part of buildings' carbon emissions is the manipulation of cold and heat. Actually, Central California, some might call the geographical middle way of the country, because it's not too cold or too hot compared to some places. Probably almost nobody has air conditioning in Santa Cruz. But we often might use heat. So we'll have to find our way to interact interdependently with the world of fossil fuels. Personally, I have the practice of not turning on the heat in my abode, except when people, since it's a Zen Center building too, when we have some event, public event where people come, then for the sake of others, we'll turn it on. And sometimes it's, I don't know if it's gotten to the 30s, but there was that one day when it was, I think, 37 outside. Well, I think insulation keeps it in the low 40s. That's the nice thing about dwellings. Takes the edge off. But some people might call that devotion to self-mortification. But personally, I actually really don't like to be cold, to be honest. I don't have much meat on my bones, and I get cold quite easily, and I actually don't like it. But I don't mind wearing many, many layers of fabric. So I think sometimes it's like we're like in a t-shirt. It's really cold outside, but we want to be in a t-shirt inside, so we turn the heat. We like, change the temperature. It's kind of a funny concept sometimes. I think of heating air for the sake of bodily comfort. But I think it's pretty ancient, right? Lighting fires in caves goes way back, right? This is, we need it for survival in some places. Heating air. No other species do that. I guess they have fur. It can add lots of layers of fur. and then I could, be quite comfortable. Pretty like a puffball sometimes. With many socks and hats and crawl under the covers if I'm studying or something. And then the sun starts coming up mid-morning and it's up in the south-facing window. Soon the house is quite warm. So there's just these hours where it's it's cool. And is that self-mortification? I mean, I should look. Because I'm actually quite comfortable once I have a lot of layers, I feel like it's actually okay. And what is the middle way? It seems to be like taking care, like a view of dependent arising, which is like watching cause and effect. I think in our modern culture, it's so easy to just like flip a switch, a light switch or a thermostat, and not really, just that's what we do, and then magically the heat and cold comes. But of course, there's an effect to this cause. I mean, there's a cause to this effect. There's also an effect to the cause. Dependent co-arising. Everything we do, every moment, is having an effect. So the middle way is being aware of this causality and intricacies of what we do. So that little flipping the switch and not really thinking about it, and then we become afraid of global warming. How can we can't eliminate yet? Maybe we can't eliminate fossil fuels completely, but like each moment we're flipping a switch or turning a key. How can we stay aware of this? It's mindfulness practice too, paying attention. So I might even propose that if we fall into either one of these extreme views, so like the extreme view of like cold really exists, cold is really something, and it's a problem, and it must be obliterated. Therefore, let's do something. So in this view of, and like, we don't have time to even like put on extra layers. Flip that switch. Sometimes it's tempting, I confess. Just to warm up the toes slightly before putting the socks on. Just a little blast. So this could be based on a view that something like cold truly exists in some independent fixed way, or the body truly exists, and so on. And then the other extreme of so that extreme view of true existence might lead to kind of neglect of watching the dependent arising of cause and effect. And then the other extreme of, well, it doesn't really, global warming is, you know, it's so abstract, maybe it doesn't really even exist at all, and let's not, you know, worry about this too much. And we flip the switch based on the view of non-existence, or a little bit nihilistic, you know. So a little bit eternalistic and a little bit nihilistic, I think we can neglect taking care of our arising, ceasing world and the living beings that inhabit it. Whereas the middle way, the view of the middle way, free from those extremes, is watching cause and effect, and including like our body and mind is part of this cause and effect, watching how this works. We can't quite figure it out, but we can pay attention. Everything matters. There aren't any beings to save, and yet we vow to save them. That's one expression of the middle way. Richard recently mentioned to me a kind of like a wish or a vow. Hope you don't mind. Can I mention this, Richard? You might not know what I'm going to say, but I know you don't mind. He said something like, because it was inspiring to me, he said, I want to relate to the world with respect and awe. I think that's what you said, something like that, right? I almost want to make this vow to relate to other beings and this world with respect and awe. And when he said that, I thought, that sounds like the middle way. And I thought particularly this, you know, the non-duality of respect and awe. Because when things are arising, when the world is appearing, that's the realm of respect. We have respect for the appearance of things. In the realm of like complete emptiness, there's nothing to respect. But the world that's arising, I vow to respect it. And the world that's ceasing moment to moment, that I can't get a hold of at all, where there's no fixed being, that world I vow to stay in awe of. naturally, when we're in touch with that world, we are in awe. I think in the realm of emptiness, there's no other response we can have other than awe. So, awe for the ultimate truth of emptiness, the non-arising, non-ceasing ultimate truth, and in the conventional truth of dependently arising appearances, we have great respect for the details of our everyday life, how we take care of light switches, heat switches, and each other.
We arrived at that together.
Yeah. Hmm.
We constructed it together, yeah.
Yeah. So all this was just like a preface to another talk that I was going to give. But I see it's already 7:30, just about. And since I want to take care of cause and effect, I'll save that talk for the next time. It's hard. I don't want to veer into self-mortification of forcing myself not to, but I'll just relax. And just drop off that talk. any questions or comments about the subtle middle way? Yes, Richard.
The hot cold analogy is a little esoteric for me.
As I said, I think that, you know, the heat kills you doesn't mean literally just die. No, that would be, I think, the extreme of self-mortification, to let yourself actually physically die. No, I think in Zen language, they sometimes use this word, kill, provocatively, because that's the first precept of not killing, right? So they, in Zen, they say things like, if you meet the Buddha, kill him, right? I think, because Zen, early Zen in China was, I think, all about being provocative. Kill the Buddha, the most sacred teacher of our whole tradition. So in general, kill here means like, you know, drop away any ideas or fixed concepts, and also like separation from. I think in particular with this cold and heat story, and the cold kills you, as I would say, it's like the cold just, you are the cold, and you are the heat. There's no you and separate from, in other words, the heat kills you as a separate being. Not literally, but the heat is so hot that it overwhelms, we might say, it overwhelms the self. We let it, and also not in some way like overwhelmed, but more like I'm totally open to the temperature of the moment. And that might mean that I put on some socks. And it might mean not in the moment. But if start to like get chilblains, which I get chilblains easily on my toes, then let's like wear socks some. And so there's the middle way. That's the, like you said, appropriate response, I think, is a great term here, because like, what is the appropriate response that is also called the middle way? Hard to say. There's no fixed appropriate response. Like when it's below a certain temperature, everyone puts their socks on. It doesn't work that way, right? It's like in any given moment, for each given person, there's some appropriate response that's basically, I think, is, again, awareness of the cause and effect of the situation. It's hard to stay so aware of that without falling into the habit of, well, it's this temperature, so I have to put on socks. It's more like, let's actually see this time. And so not falling into the extreme of self-mortification, which is painful, unworthy, and unprofitable, leads to no good result. And devotion to pursuing sense pleasure, which is, I want it to be exactly the right comfortability. I mean, we talk about climate control. It's kind of a funny term. Like, I want to control the climate to be the just exactly right. I mean, it's true in the old days they lit fires in these caves, but it was, I guess we could call that a form of climate control. But it's gotten like down to a science now. And you know, I also appreciate that in the winter, like not heating the house is, there's something kind of nice, because it's like, for myself, I kind of feel like this is really, I'm really aware that it's winter. And when the sun comes up at about like, when it starts to really warm the upper room, maybe it helps if you're at upper areas, but it's just like, it's like nectar, like that beam of sunlight on the floor where I can sit right in it is like ambrosia. It's so sweet because it's winter, and practicing at places like Tassajara and Bukokuji in Japan, and certain times of year you get these like slivers of sunlight, like get to a certain area of the temple, and certain hours, like people will congregate in those sunbeams for like an hour or something, and it's just so sweet, you know. And you really feel that. And then spring and fall is just kind of like, you kind of forget that there is a climate. And then summer, some escape, some shade, just some cool water, to really like sweat in the summer and shiver a bit in the winter is sweet. I personally feel. I really notice it and feel it. It's hard to live in this world in a way that that takes care. Respectfully takes care of all the beings in it, which each one with their unique needs and desires, and so hard. That's part of the whole interdependent cause and effect thing too, is like we hear from everybody. Sometimes like, you know, what if two-thirds of the people are like, this room is actually really comfortable temperature, but one-third says, actually, I'm really cold. And, you know, first we say, I have an extra jacket and hat and socks. And, no, I already have an extra jacket and hat and socks. Then, then how do we work with this, right? There's no fixed answer. The appropriate response, the middle way, is just moment to moment, trying to take care in a and not falling into a fixed thing of like, well, that means that next time we're in that situation, we have to do the exact same thing because that's what we had, what this group agreed on. It's like, then that would be like falling into the extreme view of existence. That's how things are. We always do it that way. And then maybe a view of non-existence would be like to completely forget. It would be like we come into the Zendo and like there's no forms here at all. How do we do service? I don't know. Ring the bell however you want. It's like, well, that's maybe the other extreme of non-existence. Like we're getting into too much, like it doesn't matter at all. How can we do our practice in the middle way? We're not like attached to the form or reject the form, but just be killed by the form. You mean we have to do another prostration? Okay, I'm just going to die into this prostration. Let this prostration pervade my being so much that there's no more me in addition to the prostration. Well, I look forward to exploring, practicing the middle way with all of you throughout this year. We dedicate any merit arising from our gathering this evening to the complete freedom and joy of all arising and ceasing living beings in this strange world. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them.